Welcome in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you for joining us here on this Thursday. We have an exciting program for you. Life after death and near-death experiences is something that I'm very intrigued with. I know on this program, I've talked quite a bit about my brushes with death, having had sepsis and having had some eerie, kind of freaky experiences with death on the other side, not having had quite that near-death experiences. And we'll go over that with our guest, Jacob Cooper, who has had a near-death experience, and we're going to talk about that today. It's intrigued me. And what's intriguing isn't necessarily the near-death experience itself. It's what people see in that near-death experience and how they come out on the other side and how it changes that person. Each story is different. Each story has its own, not really conclusion, because that story doesn't conclude until we finally do cross over. But what it is how it changes the fundamental mission of that person here on Earth. And this one is amazing. I tell you, the name of the book that Jacob brings to us today is Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality. And let me tell you a little bit about Jacob before we bring him on here. Jacob holds a Master of Social Work degree and is a licensed clinical social worker. Jacob is also a certified Reiki master, certified hypnotherapist, and specializes in past life regression therapy. As a psychotherapist, Jacob works with individuals, groups, and families in managing emotional barriers, promoting improved wellness and resiliency. Jacob also incorporates mindfulness and a spiritual approach to focus on the connection between the mind, body, and spirit. In effect, this teaches individuals how to improve their cognitive processing and shift their perspectives. Now, based on his near-death experience, which we'll talk about, and past life regressions, Jacob shares insight about the mystery of life on the other side of the veil. In addition to peace and euphoria in the afterlife, we also experience these feelings in the physical world. There is so much more to live for, he says, as we are all more resilient than we imagine. Jacob's experience also provides others with the opportunity to experience past life memories, assisting in the development of self-awareness and finding meaning in their experiences. Let's bring him on the line right now and welcome to the Darkness on the Edge of Town, Jacob Cooper. Good morning, Jacob. It's a pleasure to bring you in here. And we'll start it off slow here. And I want to find out a little bit about life before you had the near-death experience, and then we'll jump in from there. I want to know what kind of a person you were before you had this experience. Who was Jacob Cooper before you had your near-death experience?
Oh, well, thank you. Just a pleasure to be your honored guest. My near-death experience is unique. I think they all are unique. Each and every encounter that you hear, is different. But mine's unique from the position of that I was, the age of 3 years old, when I had my NDE. And so,
you were young.
In the media, you hear of people like Dr. Eben Alexander, Anita Morjani, stuff like that, Betty 80, who have had theirs, middle life, they were adults. Mm-hmm. So for me, I wasn't, kind of like as programmed, in that reality. I was just, a young infant, but I had mine. And so when I look back in my years of infancy, there's not really much that I remember other than these transformative experiences that happened for my NDE and subsequent, other encounters. And so we could get into that a little bit, but I could tell you what Jacob was after, and I'm continuing to try to write that story each and every day.
Yeah, well, now I do have a couple of questions about being that young and having that experience. First of all, you're only three. What happens at the age of three that you slip into a near-death experience? What happened? Were you ill, or did you have an accident?
Yeah, I was just a child playing in the playground, no pun intended, with God's playground and stuff like that. There's a lot of symbology and allegory with the NDE that I had. But I had something called whooping cough, otherwise known as pertussis, which led to my own suffocation, hence the title Life After Breath. But from suffocating, from the physical breath, I was really able to tap into the breath of eternity, that allowed my NDE and the subsequent euphoric experiences to transpire.
Wow. Okay, so, and I know there's this glaring question here, and I know we do have some skeptical people in the audience, as I tend to be a little skeptical as well, but you're 3 years old. I mean, I do have some friends who do remember back to being 2 and 3 years old. I unfortunately have had 7 concussions and a major post-concussive syndrome, so I don't remember a lot of anything that happened before I was 6 or 7, unfortunately. How do you remember back to 3 years old, and are things vivid from that time where you had the whooping cough? Do you remember actually feeling that ill? Do you remember vividly what happened in this near-death experience?
The surrounding events of the NDE, you know, slightly before and slightly after, are chronicled in my book. But I really credit it to the intensified trauma that I had from suffocation, which is something that I don't wish on anyone to experience. I mean, suffocating to me when I had it was just the absolute scariest moment of my life. So I think the trauma that I had it, which either, you know, could be buried or could be, you know, incredibly intensified in memory. And I'll give an example. For instance, you know, on 9/11, we all remember what we were doing, what was going on, you know, for the most part, but we don't remember what we were doing 9/15, 9/16. And so something so strikingly traumatic or profound within our lifetimes, I think we have the ability to intensify our ability to remember. But also, my NDE was not something, you know, that was processed linearly, as you know, this was beyond my brain, beyond, you know, my analytical mind. I was really tapping into a higher dimension and a higher reality. And so, you know, I think the fact of the matter is I wasn't bioneurochemically wired, you know, conventionally like we are in our own processings, you know, governed by the linear mind. I was tapped into the nonlinear mind, you know, in this experience. And I do believe that allowed me, you know, to have an ability to defy conventional, you know, memory and processing.
Well, you know, you bring that part up, and there's another part as well. As we've dealt with for the last 16 years of the show, we know that children tend to be a little more tapped into the other side tend to be a little bit more tapped into the paranormal as it is. Do you feel like being that young, you had a little bit of, you had a little bit of a more of a sensitivity to your NDE, or you had a little bit more of a connection to the other side through your NDE? Do you feel like you maybe, you know what I'm trying to get here?
I understand.
Yeah.
You know, even at the age of 3, you know, I was having my NDE, I still felt a degree of attachment, you know, to the life that I was living, you know, and so having my NDE, I was there, but I was also, you know, just thinking about the life that I lived and having a greater understanding of it. But what's interesting about NDE and what I had is, you know, there's so many things that happened in my life that I wasn't necessarily programmed to, you know, and some stuff in this lifetime, you know, that kind of went against my own belief system. And so I think that's congruent with a lot of NDEers who might grow up a Muslim or, you know, Christian or Jewish or whatever, and have a totally different vantage point than whatever they've been taught or what they experienced. So I don't think it was all that different in a sense that it had very little to do with the actual life that I was living. You know, but I think, you know, sometimes some people, when they have a degree of skepticism, there's an incubational period that happens and just kind of like they're having their own worldviews and this is presenting to them. You know, and still there's an adjustment. And so I think that happened a little bit in my NDE where it was so profound, you know, and what I was experiencing that there was an incubational period where it was just almost too overwhelming of an adjustment. Now I experienced that at 3 years old. I could imagine, you know, maybe with more cultural belief systems and programming of this world, it might take a little bit even longer for souls to get adjusted to the other side. But eventually, you know, it's smooth sailing, you know, and you're back home, you know, and acclimated.
I want to get a little bit into this NDE in a bit, but you used a key word in that last bit of what you were talking about. You used the word programmed when it came to religions. And I want to dive into that a little bit, just a bit, if you'll indulge me here. we go through certain dogmas, no matter what religion you believe in. And I don't want people in our audience to lash back at me here. But I do want to also tackle this for a moment. As someone who went through this at a very young age, obviously you have a perspective that nobody else has. You've seen the other side with fresh eyes. You haven't seen it from a perspective of someone who has been indoctrinated into one religion or another. So it's interesting that you use the word program. Now, tell me why you use the word program. What is it that you've learned that we haven't?
You know, I think there's an outer reality that we've been taught, you know, of God and, you know, of the processes of this reality. And then there's an inner awareness, you know, that's a whole different reality. And so I think it transforms the NDE and all the spiritual work transforms belief into a knowing. You know, I think a knowing is something on an inner basis that no one could tell you, that, you know, you just feel, sense, know without, you know, any doubt. Or, you know, at times, you know, belief and faith, you know, might be based off of what someone else has said or what you've been taught, you know, or something that you're holding on to, but not necessarily something, you know, that speaks to your inner awareness and inner findings and experiences.
So is the experience different than let's say I've been raised Catholic, but yet I, in my older life, maybe I don't subscribe to some of those Catholic ideals or Catholic ideology. Does that change my NDE? Does that change if I have an NDE, or does that change the way I see things when I have this experience?
You're saying what you predated, believed in, and then having an near-death experience and having that. I mean, it's very hard. To have an NDE who hasn't been changed in some way, and the majority of them subscribe more so to you know, spirituality than religion. And they tend to beat by their own drum and connect to, you know, inner reality, you know, versus an outer organized belief system. And I think you make a great point where, you know, a lot of, you know, NDEers or spiritual people tend to tear down religion. And I think there's many paths up to the mountain in a way. There's many different ways to do it. But I think the ultimate, you know, way to go about it is inward. I think that is the most profound. And, you know, that takes a very courageous, you know, brave soul many times to be able, you know, to do that, because, you know, in our life we're programmed from a very early age, or we're reared from a very early age to be, you know, not independent. You know, we're taught reality in a way. We're depending on our caregivers. You know, we're taught that we're, you know, physically a young being, and we're depending on that. When in reality, from my experience, we're an ancient soul with infinite wisdom inside, you know, in this finite body. And so I think as we develop, we're able to come more and more, in a sense, you know, of who we are, not what we've been taught to be, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And that brings about another question. So when you come about a younger human being, does that change the way you treat that younger human being? Because I know with society in general, we tend to treat children very, very condescending. And we think that we need to inflict our views and our life experiences and what we think upon them in order to shape them the way that we are. Is that the wrong way to go about things?
I don't know if I necessarily subscribe to a belief system or right and wrong. I do believe in skillfulness and, you know, what's best practice. And, you know, each child, you know, as we know, is unique and different. But I think for children, at a subconscious or maybe conscious basis, you know, it's a big adjustment. You know, they just came back from the other side. They're coming to this reality. And so many times it's diametric opposition to what they're used to on the other side. And, you know, inwardly there might be conflict too, where there's a part of them that, you know, knows that they're an ancient being, that knows they lived out their lifetimes, and all of a sudden they have to, you know, restart this and be looked at a blank canvas, when in reality, you know, there's a part of them at a deep inner level that just knows that they're not this body, and they're not how the world sees them, perceives them. And so, yeah, I think it's very important, you know, to you know, find ways to learn how to have unconditional love and support, you know, for your children. Because, you know, right now, certainly in mental health field, I've seen an immense amount of issues that really come from, you know, deep-rooted self-esteem barriers. And I think the society that we're living in, you know, really intensifies a lot of, you know, underdeveloped or, you know, just not probably developed, you know, foundations of self-esteem, because what we, you know, if we do something, then we're able to feel a certain way about our things. So, you know, what we do is synonymous with who we are, you know, not what we are is enough. So, you know, there's a transactional dynamic with identity. You know, you get that good grade on the test, you get reinforced, you get bad, you know, negative. And so it's no wonder why there's an unstable sense of self and, you know, identity from this conditional, you know, parenting that many experience. And that's different than what I experienced on the other side, you know, where there was unconditional love for not what you did, but who you are. You know, that makes sense.
So this kind of transitions us back to the other side in a way. Mm-hmm. Are you saying there is no negative? I don't want to say negative. There is no consequences for negative behavior in life. Mind you, as a 3-year-old, you're not going to have negative consequences. You really haven't done anything to suffer negative consequences. But did you get the impression that there were no negative consequences for negative action?
Well, I think it's all a matter of perspective. What we view as a negative consequence could also be seen as an opportunity in our development, you know, to learn, grow, and evolve from. You know, so it's just, you know, everything's a matter of, you know, perspective. And, you know, that's really, you know, the way that I saw my NDE from understanding my past lives and, you know, having a life review, that, you know, there was opportunities within lifetimes to really have an understanding, you know, of the boards on the chess move that, you know, the soul made and, you know, what I made and how we could, you know, move it to a place of more skillfulness and how we could learn from that. And I think really the soul on a deeper level knows, but it's here to integrate, because the integration becomes embedded, you know, in our evolution.
So is the answer to really, really getting it wrong in one lifetime coming back and really, really getting it right, rather than, you know, the eternal damnation that we hear of in some dogma?
I don't think you're ever experienced that. It's more of an ability to rise and evolve your inner being and, you know, continue to develop that. So, you know, for instance, in our reality, it's very linear in how we process things. We say a mistake and that's the end of it. You know, we're a continuing, you know, evolving eternal being. And so for someone to make a mistake, but you learn from it Thursday or Friday, is that really a mistake? I mean, to me, that's growth. And now, if you're not learning from that, then, you know, obviously, you know, that becomes a pattern. But I do believe in a sense that messages throughout lifetimes are repeated until those deeper lessons are embedded and embraced. And so, you know, I think that's a part of our journey, is really evolving learning in this life school.
Now, Jacob, this is where some people would take umbrage with the fact that there's a difference between a mistake and just a plain out sin against humanity. You know, that, you know, when you go out and shoot up a school, or you go out and commit mass murder, or you go out and, you know, you sell drugs to kids, or you do things that you know for a fact you're doing consciously without a conscience, you know what I'm saying?
Vindictive behavior. Sure.
Yes, yes. These are things that you know you're doing. You have no guilty conscience over. This is not a mistake. This is not something that, oops, you know, I'll make good on it later. Where's that dividing line as far as the divine goes?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, when it comes to life review and what I experienced and many other near-death experiencers, you know, have noticed is that you're able to feel, sense, and understand the cause and effect of your actions and others. And so at the time, for whatever reason, a lot of people just become numb to this or so separated, you know, by their truth and so buried, you know, within themselves. And, you know, many times there's a lot of, you know, mental illness that comes into play as well. You know, each situation is different, but, you know, eventually, you know, the soul has to really, you know, face that, you know, and experience that. And, you know, maybe in that lifetime, the soul didn't have the ability or didn't want to, but eventually, you know, all things come to the light, you know, even our, you know, our greatest darkness, if that makes sense. So again, it's all a matter of perspective, but eventually, you know, souls, you know, need to really face, you know, what they did. And that's, you know, not a punishment, but again, the opportunity of the journey of the soul to really rectify, you know, and learn, you know, and grow from, you know, their actions.
This may seem like an odd question, but is that something that's rectified in one lifetime, two lifetimes? How long does it take to to grow that out?
Just imagine with some of the mass murders that have happened throughout time, if that's, you know, I don't know. I it's hard to say. You know, it really is, because, you know, I think there's a subjective journey to each one, and there's an intelligence far greater than our own, you know, orchestrating our development and, you know, lifetimes. And so it's hard to say if it's one lifetime, two lifetimes, but geez, you'd imagine, you know, someone like Adolf Hitler, you know, 10 million plus, you know, people murdered, it, you know, is that justifiable in one or two lifetimes? Of, I don't know. I can't answer that, but, you know, we just hope that, you know, there's growth, there's understanding, there's evolution, you know, from each and every lifetime, you know, going forward.
I want to get back into your NDE here, and we're going to get back to the more overwhelming topics a little bit later in the program, because I do want to tie that to your more metaphysical practice a little bit later. Let's get back to your NDE now. We were talking about, as you're making that transition over to the other side, and I realized that, you know, at a younger age, I did start it off by saying we tackled the word programming. And with that, I have to ask this question. You know, a lot of times we hear about the stereotypical NDE. You see the bright light, you see relatives, some people see angels, some people see different things. As you're having this NDE, do you remember seeing something particular like that, stereotypical? Or did you see something different at the beginning of it?
Yes. I mean, I had a lot of the classical, examples of near-death experiences, from soul family to life review to angels to awareness of, you know, God, you know, it, you know, in our vernacular is what I would say. But I think it's a little bit different in a sense that near-death experiences tend to highlight a lot of the euphoric elements of it, which I experience in a lot of the, you know, mystical elements on either side, but they don't highlight enough of, you know, the trauma that, you know, and many endure. And so at least for myself, it was incredible torture, suffocating at such a young age, and something that still sticks with me. And so I think near-death experiences have really gained a lot of popular traction through enormous media outlets, and I know Netflix Surviving Death was, you know, something that really helped it out in the last year or two. But yeah, a lot of people want these experiences, and I just, you know, I would say it's not something that you necessarily want, you know, because of what you have to go through. It's worth it, but it does create, you know, a little bit of conflict in life and a little bit of difficulty, you know, at times, and it's something that really has to be properly processed and grounded, and it takes time to integrate. You know, so the work that I do is, you know, not to want people to have near-death experiences, but to understand that they're able to really have this stuff without needing to die, that you could live without needing to, you know, die in a way, or have this traumatic experience, and you could open up consciousness without, you know, all this trauma that I experienced.
Which is a true statement. I had teased earlier in the program that I've had a couple different brushes, I guess, but never anything like you've had. And I guess I wanted to describe the one to you. Our audience is familiar with it, but I, gosh, it was probably closer to like 4 or 5 years ago now. I had sepsis from an infection, and I was in the hospital, and I was at a point where my blood sugar was incredibly low. I think it was around 25 or 30. My blood pressure was getting to the point where it was so low, it was getting hard to register. I remember the room going dark. Everything was going dark around the, they had two nurses working at me on me at the time. They were getting ready to call a doctor in. And I remember just everything going dark around me. It, like the edges of the room were going dark, and I remember starting to like pass out. And I remember one of the nurses saying, "We're losing him, we're losing him." And I thought, this can't be how it ends, because you know, there's no light, there's no anything. And I remember fighting. I just remember thinking, I'm not letting it end this way. And I have one nurse who's trying to kind of put this lemony, it looked like lemony snot, Jacob, I'm not going to lie. This is what this okay. stuff looked like. And she's trying to feed it to me.
Tell it like it is, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was like pastry tubes of lemony snot that she's shoving in my mouth. And so she's expecting me to eat this stuff. And the other one is monitoring my blood pressure, and I'm just trying to swallow that stuff at the same time. I'm thinking, you know, it was like drowning. It was exactly like drowning, but in lemony snot. And I'm at the time, I'm just thinking, you know, I just got to get through this. I'm not dying this way. That was the one thing on my mind. And I don't know if you want to call it a miracle, whatever it was. The blood sugar starts to come up a little bit to like around the 50s. The blood pressure starts to come up just a little bit, just enough to kind of keep me here. And the edges of the room go from dark to a little bit lighter to where I can see things. And it was only through, and this part, I guess I've never told publicly before, but it was only through talking to, a medium of sorts, I guess you could say, I'll say of sorts, that they said it was only because you weren't meant to go that day. That's why you didn't have the NDE. You just weren't meant to die, and you weren't meant to see what you weren't meant to see. It was never in the cards. It was just, not only were you not meant to die, you weren't meant to see what was on the other side. That's why you didn't see it. You didn't even get to the edge of seeing anything. So I had to be okay with that. And in that kind of fired up my faith again. So I said, okay, good. That means that, you know, I don't have to sit there and go, oh, there's, you know, I don't have to go back into, not that I ever was in full atheist mode or anything like that, but I didn't have to have doubt, because there was, to me, an answer. At least in my little world, there's an answer. You know, to me, there's levels. There's levels of human sickness, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, and again, it comes back to, you know, our awareness of events versus an unlimited intelligence, you know, far greater than our own understanding, you know, that doesn't always make sense in the surface value. And so I think, you know, like I agree with the medium where, you know, a near-death experience is one of the most profound events that one could have in their lifetime. And you know, to me, at least, it's something that, you know, 9 times out of 10 is orchestrated before we get here. It's a part of our path, and it's, you know, it's meant there. And I have my definite reasons, you know, hopefully we could talk about on the show as to why I feel that I had my NDE.
Yeah.
But well, I think many times it has to do with, you know, a soul's readiness, a soul's calling, you know, it could even be, you know, really related to previous carnations, which I do believe my NDE, you know, was related to a past life.
Well, you know what? Let's take our break right now. When we come back, let's talk about that. Let's talk about why you had your NDE when you had it and why it came out the way it came out and what it had to do with your life's purpose. Because 3 years old is incredibly young to be having an NDE. Jacob Cooper is our guest. The book is Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality. The website is jacoblcooper.com. Check it out during the break. We have a link to it also in the description of this program. When we come back, we'll find out why Jacob had this NDE at such a young age and how it shaped the rest of his life. We've got more coming up for you next. You're listening to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest today is Jacob L. Cooper. The book is Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality. Check out the website, jacoblcooper.com. Jacob, the book, I believe, is also available at amazon.com. We've got links to it on the description of the show. Do you have signed copies available of the book?
I do.
Okay. Now, before the break, we were teasing a little bit about why you would have this near-death experience at such a young age. I mean, 3 years old is an incredibly young age to have an NDE. What was your understanding? Why have this near-death experience at such a young age?
Well, in part of having my near-death experience, I was able to go back to different carnations, which I highlight, you know, in Life After Breath. But one of those carnations, you know, I was able to see a lifetime in which I was a teacher of students. And I just saw that I committed suicide. I took, you know, my own body. I can't say life because life, is eternal. But I took I committed suicide. In that moment, I was profoundly aware, had I really just kind of like stuck it out, things would have evolved, things would have changed. And I was, able to really go back into that lifetime and just remember going into the light and, not being judged, but more from an understanding of lessons. But it came just very emotional with seeing the students of that lifetime and just feeling like I had something more on the table, that there was unfinished, issues, and there was a lesson behind that lifetime. And I just remember in that lifetime within my NDE and subsequent child events that I just remember my back be against the wall and I would just get this recurring scene, and I just remember people being around me and I just took my life. And this is something that I had, recurrently. And I actually, in my book talk about it, where I went to an intuitive and she picked up on that exact lifetime that I had with exactly what I was seeing. And this happened through several other intuitives and mediums, prior to me going public as well, with more validation to it. Do the near-death experience, really was about trusting the light inside of me versus the darkness in front of me. And so, suffocating, and losing my own, breath really allowed me to, tap into the breath of eternity, that no matter how deprived we are of life force, there's always something inside of us and all around us to propel us forward, with any challenge. And so that was, I really kind of forgot what was inside of me and around me and defined myself by what I was, facing in my life. And I was kind of turning the wrong way in my life. I was facing everything, on the outside instead of really turning to all that I had within, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And one of the things that I'm curious about is, has there been more than one life as you, not only as you go into your past lives, but maybe even as you worked with the medium, where suffocation was prevalent in that life?
Not within that lifetime. So, we didn't really, get into that. But I just think suffocation speaks so much to the purpose of the near-death experience, in a sense that, when we're struggling, when we're suffering, we feel just incredibly suffocated and out of breath. And we're able to tune into our real breath, which is, you know, who we are, which was the breath of eternity that we were bestowed with, you know, which in Judaism, the religion that I come from, is the word for spirit is ruach, which means the wind of God. And so, you know, I think really when we're tapping into that, we're really able to be a lot more resilient within our lifetime. So it's not just, you know, physical breath that we're breathing, but we're really breathing in, you know, our essence and connecting to, you know, life force.
I find that really interesting. I've never heard it approached that way. That's why I asked if there was more than one life that was connected to suffocation. But I get it when you put it that way. That's a really, really interesting perspective.
Right. And, you know, it's from completion we begin. And so I just almost had to face, you know, that same kind of feeling that I had, you know, when I committed suicide, you know, my own suffocation, my near-death experience. And it's almost sometimes to remember the light, we have to see its polar opposites. And that's just, you know, kind of how things go. And at the end of the day, that's all that I saw that ever lasted. And everything else, you know, kind of came back to, in a way, the nothingness, you know, of it was, which I'm talking long term. And so I think a pillar of resilience is really identifying, you know, what the universe is about. As Einstein would say, is it working with us or against us? Is it a limited place? You know, and really what we're governing our lives by, is it by, you know, the story of pain and suffering and struggle, or are we defining it by, you know, a greater sense of purpose, and to really not be defined by our stories, but to define it from a higher perspective.
So let me ask you this, Jacob. You're having your near-death experience. Is the message delivered to you during the near-death experience that you're to, again, you were a teacher in a previous life, that now you're to teach and serve man one more time to let them know about what's on the other side?
Yes, that was within my near-death experience. I was able to have future premonitions of what I would be doing in my lifetime, and I was able to see, you know, groups and crowds of people that I was presented with. So yes, that same continuum was there, you know, but the opportunity to really evolve what I kind of got stuck with in that lifetime and to progress that was, to me, heaven. I mean, to me, heaven, you know, or the other side, is really progressing places where we're getting stuck and really, you know, accelerating, you know, the soul's evolution, you know, from that opportunity. And so, as beautiful as the other side is, integrating that message within my own lifetime and others was a way that we didn't have to wait for the body to die to have awareness or to, you know, be on the other side, that we could integrate who we are, what we're connected to, you know, whether in the physical body or not, you know, that's our inner being. That's something we're forever connected to.
So, you know, you got to admit, Jacob, we walk around with blinders on in this lifetime. We really are connected to the physical and the here and now. And when you tell people, well, we can connect to these wonderful gifts from the other side and we can really open up, You kind of get a little bit of an eye roll from people at times. let me ask you, how do you, if you're trying to present this to people, just ordinary people, even someone who may be listening to this podcast right now, how do you kind of cold sell or cold call somebody and say, here's how you can kind of connect to the divine and open this up a little bit and do this for yourself? How do you open that up to people?
Well, first, I think it really, you know, for many, they have to have a certain readiness. I can't speak of anything that people don't want or don't, you know, feel that they could utilize. You know, if they're resistant, you know, that's, you know, where they're at. And so that's not really who I turn to or I speak to. I speak to people who are on this path, who want to continue to evolve it. You know, that's really the ones who are receptive to it. I still talk, you know, whether you want to swat it away or integrate it, you know, that's everyone's own empowerment that I think is great in their own discernment. But, you know, I would say it's the vantage point that we live our life by and how we see ourselves and perceive ourselves will impact the life that we live. If we just see ourselves as a physical being and that's all that we see ourselves, then that's what we'll cater to. I think if we're able to perceive ourselves as more than just this body, you know, as a multidimensional being, then we'll be more motivated to care for that. I mean, for instance, if our stomach is hungry, we see ourselves as a physical being that's tangible, we'll feed it. But if there's another part of ourselves that's hungry and that's less tangible or less acknowledged, then we'll just let it go. But eventually, you know, that part of us becomes almost numb and empty. And so it's no wonder why people are just, you know, running for their soul's purpose or wanting to know who they are and stuff like that, because they're not nourishing, you know, that part of them. They're not listening to that part of them. They're looking, you know, outside to kind of feed an inner part of themselves. And so I think it takes an inner approach and inner awareness to kind of nurture, you know, these inner dimensions of ourselves.
So if someone says to you, well, Jacob, I got so much on my plate, man. I got kids, I got jobs, I got, sure, you know, I've got everything going on here and I can't think past tomorrow. What's mm-hmm. the worst thing that happens if I just live out my life and do what I got to do to get by? What's the price on my soul if I live from here to the grave and just deal with what I got to deal with? What's the weight on my soul when I pass? Even if I'm a good guy, I go to church, I do what I got to do. What happens to me when I die?
Well, I think that's something that you would probably have to figure out. I wouldn't be able to answer that for you, but I don't think we just came here to survive. I think we came here in our own unique ways to thrive, I would think. You know, we're not just here to just cater to the body and just, you know, cater to what's in front of us. I think, you know, on average, we came here for more of that. But I think if that is satisfactory to the person, you know, then that's fine. But, you know, on a deeper inner level, you know, I think we're here for a soulful experience. And we're here to really remember who we are and just, you know, have, you know, an expanded lifetime and not, you know, something just kind of, you know, mundane. But some people are satisfied with that. I couldn't answer. You know, some people are okay with that, and that's not my job to judge.
Is there a price ultimately? I mean, when it comes time for that life reveal, if you have to sit there and watch your life reveal, is it positive or negative, or is it just kind of a boring movie?
It can be rather mundane. I mean, it's funny with past life regressions. I mean, everyone wants to be Cleopatra and stuff like that, but some people, you know, their lives were a little bit more mundane, you know, and they were having pitchforks and stuff like that. And, you know, it might just be that's just a part of their soul's, you know, journey is, you know, they're having different experiences of the soul. And maybe next incarnation, it's something a little bit more expansive, you know, but everyone's at a different part of their own journey. I mean, some souls, you know, like there might be in first or second grade in development. And so, you know, it might be more of a basic, you know, lifetime that they live. And as they evolve and as, you know, they grow, they need to kind of feed a deeper part of themselves that they just can't ignore anymore. And so I think really, you know, it's, you know, hopefully we're able to do this without needing to reincarnate, but just remembering who you are, what's inside of you, and not, you know, bearing that part of you down, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. What is the importance of somebody wanting to know their past lives? What does it do for somebody now to know what they were couple hundred years ago, or even a couple thousand years ago?
Yeah, I think it, you know, it provides a multitude of benefits. I mean, the first being, you know, from what I've seen, just from a basic, you know, trauma perspective, where clients might come into my office and they're just uncertain of a certain phobia or certain tendency that they have, and they've tried, you know, every modality of psychotherapy, they've tried psychotropic medication, it doesn't seem to work. And then we're able to delve a little bit deeper into the subconscious. And, you know, whether it's an age regression, which is really, you know, this lifetime, or a past life regression, you know, they're really able to go more towards the point of entry, you know, of a period that happened, you know, predated this experience. You know, that's, you know, a bit of the cog on the wheel, so to speak. But for others, it could give, you know, greater explanations to, you know, different tendencies of family members, and to see maybe their roles on this play, you know, and who they were in other lifetimes, you know, in different awarenesses. It could give you know, just an exploratory, you know, value for people to kind of know, okay, I was in, you know, ancient Egypt, and this is why, you know, I love going to the Middle East and stuff like that, or, you know, or something like, so it could give a little bit more of an insight into why we gravitate towards different cultures and different places. But on a bigger level, it could, on a larger level, at least to me, it could have a similar effect to a near-death experience. And I say we divide these experiences, like near-death experiences, past lives, you know, the spiritual transformative experiences. But to me, you know, I don't see them as separate. They're just different paths up the mountain, but a similar result of elevated consciousness. And, you know, past life regression could really allow someone to know that we don't die, that we continue, you know, past the body, and we celebrate life in different bodies and different dynamics, but we just kind of know that we, you know, continue in our own unique ways. And, you know, it could also give a greater understanding of, you know, some of the lessons involved and some of the life themes from this lifetime, as well as greater gifts that you might carry over. I think it's not all pathologized or negative. There could be some greater positivity to be integrated from other lifetimes. So it's very broad based in its benefits. It's endless to me. I mean, even from a health perspective, again, I'm not a medical doctor, but, you know, some people, you know, I've heard cases of people who couldn't see, for instance, and, you know, they're about to get eye surgery and they had a regression. They found out they were, let's say, burned in the eyes in another lifetime. Whether you want to view that as hokey or not, from that regression, they were able to see fine. They didn't need regressions. And so whether we think it's hokey or not, you know, the fact of the matter is it does have a lot of benefits, you know, to transform people's lives.
So have you ever been able to heal somebody through a soul retrieval by taking fractured pieces from these past lives and bringing it back into this time?
I don't think I really heal anyone. I think the person allows the healing to take, you know, I just kind of facilitate it. Mm-hmm. But we've seen progress. You know, we've seen, you know, in my practice, we've seen a lot of people really expand their lives and, you know, come from a place of a deeper place and just more of that knowingness and really able to engage a lot differently, you know, and skillfully with challenges of their lives. So, you know, I have seen people making progress, you know, in their lifetimes, you know, and in their lifetime from the regression.
Interesting. So how many Cleopatras have you had in your office? I'm just curious.
I haven't had one, but, you know, I've had people who think that they are, but you have to ask which one were you, because there were, what, six or seven of them?
Yeah.
So that's non-specified, but you know, everyone, and then again, that kind of deals with the world that we live in, where everyone, you know, wants to be this, you know, grand star. But if you look at all the spiritual masters of all time, you know, they don't see what other people see in them. Their message is, whatever you see in me is in you too. Right? Mm-hmm. And that same file, that same fabric is in you. And so I think it's very important for people to just be able to be empowered in their own life to see what they see in another, to see in themselves too. You know, it's interconnected. But, you know, you have to look at different public figures and just wonder, you know, for them to be where they are, you just kind of wonder what they were doing in the 1920s, 1930s, or beyond, you know what I'm saying? Beyond.
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's a recycled, you know, kind of theme with them and now in many ways in that generation now. But the most interesting thing that I had happened was I was doing a regression. It was in ancient Egypt. And even another practitioner had the same exact experience where, you know, after the regression, two people pointed at each other and they just remembered that they were in that lifetime together. And, you know, instantaneously they knew. And so ancient Egypt, I think, is one of the longest period of history. And I guarantee, you know, it's most likely that, you know, a lot of us have had, you know, lifetimes in that lifetime from its elongated period. But it was just so funny, the spontaneity of just how I just saw them. They just pointed at each other and they just both had a spontaneous understanding of their, you know, journeys together in that lifetime.
Well, between Egypt and Rome and Greece, I'm surprised there aren't more people that don't remember being together in Rome or Greece.
Yeah, you know, it's, I've seen it within time, but yeah, I mean, those are also big periods, but it's for whatever reason, ancient Egypt seems to be, throughout a lot of my colleagues, like a major, you know, lifetimes, you know, that people have, but it varies, it's different. I mean, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that period tends to get romanticized too amongst people who who get into past life regression too. I don't know.
Right. There is the fantasy element, like we were talking about the Cleopatra thing too. So
yeah.
Right. It's very important to ground fantasy versus, okay, this is actually transpiring and happening. And like we said before, you know, most people in a lot of my regressions that I do, they're not like, the, you know, they have a pitchfork in their hand, they're on a farm, they're working the land, and it's not like, you know, anything climactical or, you know, or expansive in a way. It's rather mundane. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Jacob. You also are a certified Reiki master. Do you teach Reiki?
I provide, you know, teaching to students who are called in my path. You know, really what I do a lot these days is Reiki 1, mm-hmm. which is really self-healing, you know, in incorporating Reiki towards yourself. And I just find, you know, everyone wants to be this kind of macho healer, but mm-hmm. I think the important part is if you don't start with you, how could you do it to another? And that's what right. I love about the system of Reiki. It really goes about it the right approach where it starts with you. You know, then when your cup is full, you know, you could maybe move on to someone else. So, you know, I really trust the practice of it and, you know, how it works. But you know, I came to Reiki because many reasons, but so much of the life that I experienced has been informed by my near-death experience. You know, for instance, you know, moments of suffocation, I was given, you know, my life back, and I was shown eternal life, and I was shown all these things. And so my work as a psychotherapist, Reiki master, you know, all this other stuff is just to allow people to take back life force when that's taken from them. And Reiki itself means universal life force. Rei is universal and ki is life force, or, you know, so really it's allowing people to get back that life force when they're feeling deprived, you know, of the soulful oxygen of their lifetimes, if you will.
Now, what I find interesting is, especially in times like this, and I'm not going to by any means connect a pandemic with self-energy, but I find that in times of great sickness, and we are in one of those times of great sickness, it seems like we tend to let ourselves go, and that's when we tend to get, you know, the most sick. Mm-hmm. We really aren't focusing on ourselves, and we haven't been focusing on ourselves for decades. How do you propose to kind of spread that message that we really do need to start? Not just, you know, because diet and exercise is one of those things that I think we get beat over the head with. And everybody proposes at the new year, which we're coming up on, to diet and exercise. And everybody hits the gym for 2 weeks and then they leave. But how do you propose to people that there's other ways of looking after yourself? Or really, how do you propose to people that, you know, there are alternate ways to really start looking after yourself, and how do you get people to do that?
Right. Well, again, it's if we're having finite ways to cater to our finite sense of reality in our body, in our tangible body, you know, then change, you know, isn't going to be as stable. You know, I think all real change starts within, and that's what I love, like a program like Noom, per se, and I'm not endorsing a Noom mm-hmm. or other programs where they incorporate, you know, the inner part of change, incorporate psychology, where it's not just a matter of looking in the mirror and thinking that you're $1 million. No, I mean, that's just, you know, you could have people who don't look like that, but who are healthy within. So I think really it's starting within, setting our attention towards our intentions, you know, and being mindful of that, you know, what is it based in? Is it based off of, you know, kind of superficial, you know, kind of purposes? Is it rooted rather, you know, in deep reasoning, you know, in deep drive? And so I think for things to last, we have to really check the foundation of our changes. But again, I think a lot of it stems down to self-worth, self-value. You know, if you have a beat up car that you don't respect, you're not going to take very good care of it. Whereas you have a Tesla, Bentley, you're going to take really good care of it. And so I think it's a lot of it is a self-esteem thing in terms of self-care and seeing that investment as worthy and believing in your own self-resilience to be able to not sabotage your life and throw it away, but rather to invest, you know, to make the most important investment, which is in you.
And with that, Jacob, let me ask you this. it's hard for us, I think, on a day-to-day basis. Right. Part of that taking care of ourselves, and part of that feeling like a Tesla, I'll put that right back at you, is feeling that divine love. And I think part of feeling that divine love is feeling connected. And a lot of us don't feel connected. And in that, I'm kind of pulling this whole full circle back onto you. With that, I know we can go right back to your book here, Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality, and tell people to pick up that book and get an idea of how to become better connected with the other side. And by the way, folks, there are some pretty heavy hitters here who endorse the book. Dr. Raymond Moody endorses the book. Our friend Mark Anthony endorses the book as well. And Joyce Keller, who's been on the show quite a few times as well.
Yeah, we also have Anita Morjani, who's a New York Times bestseller. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bernie Siegel, who's a New York Times bestseller. And Suzanne Giesemann, so very blessed with the company of support.
Yeah. So with that being said, I guess I would ask you, if someone who's listening to this podcast today is thinking to themselves, okay, I just need one or two ways that I can start today kind of trying to feel something from the other side, because I'm walking around pretty much empty. You know, I feel empty. I don't feel any connection to the other side. I don't feel a thing. I'm pretty much just going to work, raising kids, you know, putting money in my bank account and paying bills. That's my life right now. How would you suggest to somebody if they just, they want to try to open up to the other side, they want to try to live a more spiritual life, if you had to give somebody one or two things to do to try to start living a more spiritual life, what would you suggest?
I would say so much of identification isn't in doing, but rather in a sense of being, a state of awareness. And so we're focused on all those outside roles. You know, that's the doing, that's the action. And I think we have to be more mindful and more present and focus on, you know, how we're processing, how we're being present. You know, you could do a million things and you could live a very empty life if you're not connected, or do very little things, but you stay connected. You know, so it's not a matter of the amount of years in our life, but the matter of the presence of life within those years. And so I think it's important to stay present while we're in the present, and to live while we live, to not judge and compare. We're very focused on the specific, you know, parts of ourselves, but not more important. Not, you know, the majority of life is how we process it, not necessarily, you know, the outer presentation of it. And so it's not important. It's important to not judge, you know, ourselves as we might be doing mundane things, but we're not mundane beings. And I think the second part is learning how to get quiet. And by that I mean get loud, because when you're getting quiet, you know, it means you're tuning in to a really deeper frequency. You're tuning in to a deeper awareness past your thoughts, past barriers, you know, to this. And so I think meditation is, in a way, an intimacy with eternity, you know, because people who I've really counseled with and worked with, they get to this place and they just know that, you know, when they die, when their body goes, they tap into a part of themselves that they know, you know, will just go on. And that's really the essence of who you are and the eternity that you're connected to. And so I think it's important to learn how to live your life past your own thoughts, past your own processes, and being able to surrender, you know, to a greater reality, which is a very vulnerable position. But I think in the way part of it is, in order to really discover yourself, you have to be, in a way, willing to be vulnerable and lose, you know, a part of how you perceive reality or what you're holding on to. You know, living life open-ended versus close-ended, you know, will allow greater expansion and greater transformation to occur. If we're just constantly holding on to a set circumstances of reality, it's very hard to move the needle. And so, you know, even someone who had a near-death experience, that's not close-ended for me. To me, life is forever unfolding, and I'm always, you know, open to infinite possibilities at any given moment in time. And so I think it's being very open on an inner level to what comes to you, and being very aware and being mindful, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. One of the things I was curious about, and you were talking about this earlier, was when it was unfolded in front of you that, that you were going to be teaching these people and that, you know, you saw these faces. Do you remember any of these faces? When you see these faces, maybe come into your office or you make contact with these faces, do you get kind of a chill or a deja vu feeling? Or
it does seem like a lot of the people that I work with sometimes, they just have some symmetry with those people that I did work with. And, you know, but again, it's, you know, there's a familiarity with the work that I'm doing. There's an awareness mm-hmm. that I'm doing, but there's also a mindfulness of doing things a little bit differently and seeing things a little bit differently, knowing that, you know, still this life is not random, that, you know, that there is a school of it, and learning how to integrate wisdom within moments of adversity and challenge is something that, you know, is universally applicable. But a lot of the people that I work with, there's a lot of symmetry, you know, some of those, you know, people. But, you know, even in the work that I do as a psychotherapist is very much related to my own lifetime in which I committed suicide. And so I do believe, you know, people who commit suicide on the other side, they work, you know, in groups of souls towards, you know, that particular area. But even when they reincarnate, I do believe it's a part of their life's work. And so I do work with a lot of people who, you know, are depressed or dealing with suicidal ideations or attempts, you know, and stuff like that. And so much of this work isn't so much about what I experienced, but learning to have meaning and a sense of purpose past, you know, that lifetime, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. This may seem like an odd question, Jacob, and don't take this wrong at all. When you're sitting down with somebody who says they're contemplating suicide as a psychotherapist, have you ever brought up the past life of committing suicide and given them a different perspective as to why they shouldn't do it?
I'm a little bit hand-tied in psychotherapy. I mean, I know it's, it's evolving. You know, we're starting to see a lot of matriculation from Eastern, you know, belief systems rooted in practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but still, I mean, you're still, you know, kind of limited, you know, and just in terms of the relationship.
Right.
But that's more something that I do maybe more so in the, you know, book that I'm next writing.
Okay.
You know, that I'm working on, which is a whole chapter dedicated to the afterlife and suicide.
Okay.
Because I found that so many parents and clients, you know, that I'm working with have family members who committed suicide, or they're struggling, you know, with going back and forth with it. And so finding, I do believe there's a spiritual solution to every problem in a way, and there's a higher awareness that we could choose to integrate, you know, to really engage with suicide. So that's really what I'm trying to do, but it's more so, you know, in a lecture, you know, standpoint, or in some of my other groups that we have that conversation.
I know it, and it may seem clinically inappropriate, you know, right, to bring that up. And I know you kind of shirk when I say it. But in a way, I can't help but think that, you know, the attempt is the cry for help. You know, the suicide attempt is the, just the attempt in itself is right, saying that they're hurting. Right. Actually going through with it is the crying out of pain, of wanting to get out of pain. So I, you know, to have said that, you know, that, hey, you know, this happened to me in a past life and I can relate, is to say that, you know, I'm on the same wavelength as you, and maybe we can talk this out rather than have you think about going through with it, you know?
Right. Right. And you know, it's again, I hope to come to a day where, you know, all that kind of stuff is embraced, because that's incredibly helpful. And so in some of the coaching stuff, when there's more autonomy, you know, and kind of less restriction, you know, those other rungs I'm able to utilize. But you bring up a great point, because when someone is struggling, I think, again, to me, I relate it to the suffocating feeling that I had. It's a feeling of intense, you know, isolation and loneliness in what you're experiencing. And when you're able to have a little bit, you know, more universality, you know, it can support, it can, help, and it can allow someone to feel a little bit more carried and, connected when they're feeling very disconnected and very alone. So that's a wonderful point.
Yeah, exactly. I think we'll leave it at that, Jacob. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I appreciate you joining us today. The book is Life After Breath, How a Brush with Fatality Gave Me a Glimpse of Immortality. It's published by Waterside Productions. Please, folks, go out and get yourself a copy. Like I said, some heavy hitters have endorsed this book, and it is a great book. Jacob L. Cooper has been our guest. You can go to jacoblcooper.com and check out the book. Also, it's available right now on Amazon.com. All of the links are available right now in the description of this program. So you have no excuse. You can go ahead and click those links and check out that program. Folks, I want to thank you very much for joining us this week for these episodes. And I want to encourage you to keep clicking that subscribe button if you haven't subscribed already to Darkness Radio. And by all means, rate and review the program. Give us 5 stars, would you? And by all means, weigh in on Darkness Radio. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. Join us again next week for more in the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.